Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good morning, New Orleans. We have a great lineup for you today. In the last hour, NOPD Chief Sean Ferguson joins us to talk about the juvenile crime trends around the city, and we look forward to hearing from him. In the second hour, Arthur Sturbkow joins us, legal real estate analyst, about a Rent.com report that says that New Orleans is leading the nation in rent reduction over the past year, and that rental property is getting cheaper. We've talked a lot about affordable housing because of some of what has been going on with new development and what some people want to refer to as gentrification, and we'll find out what's driving the numbers in that report in the second hour. In this hour, we are very fortunate to have representatives from Court Watch NOLA, Simone Levine and Veronica Bard, right? They issue an annual report every year, and we've been very, I think this is the third time, if I'm not mistaken, Simone, that you guys have joined us with the release of your annual report. Welcome to the show, and thank you.
Thanks so much, Noel.
So you guys spend a lot of time with volunteers in the courts.
That's right.
Observing and looking and trying to understand certain things that are being done. It's a large report, 80-something pages.
Yes, it's taken us a long time to put together.
I went through it last night and again this morning, some very interesting observations. So why don't you tell us about, what the highlights are for you and what do you think is some of the most important items out of this report?
Sure. Thanks so much, Noel. So one of the things that we were looking at was financial impropriety by judges in criminal district court and also in magistrate court. Specifically, we had looked to see the ankle monitoring cases. That's when criminal defendants are required to wear ankle monitors that were required by judges in criminal district court and also in magistrate court. Specifically, we had found then one judge, that's Judge Paul Bonin, had ties to an ankle monitoring company, received a campaign loan, and also received campaign cash from this ankle monitoring company, and then that this judge would steer defendants to that company. We found that the judge
Let me stop right there, because the nomenclature that you're using is a little bit problematic for me. When we say campaign cash, we mean he received a campaign donation.
That's right, campaign donation.
Right, because you're not allowed to take cash.
That's right.
Okay, so
or at least not under cash in large amounts.
I think it's less than $25 or something. Yeah. Without a name being associated with it and a social security number. So it was a campaign donation that he received.
It was campaign donations.
Okay. All right.
Yep. And what specifically he would then, what he would do is if those defendants had not paid the money that they owed to that private ankle monitoring company, that he had on occasion told them that he would not release them from the ankle monitor until they paid the fees that they owed to the ankle monitoring company. And he would also...
So what's the issue with that? I mean, what should the sanction be? That's part of the sentence, is it not? I mean, that's part of your probation or part of, what you're sentenced to. You get a benefit, and it's a privilege to be put on ankle monitoring as opposed to going to jail. And with that, you sign a contract knowing that you have terms and conditions that you have to fulfill on the front end.
Right. So I think what the public should really know is that it blurs the public-private line. We want to make sure that judges are requiring ankle monitoring because it complies with public safety. However, if they have a connection to the company, if they're receiving campaign contributions, and then they say that the individual hasn't paid that private company what they owe and that they'll put the defendant back in jail if they don't pay that private company, then that's what's problematic. It blurs that public-private line. We want to make sure that judges are instituting ankle monitors because it's about public safety. We don't want to think that it's because this company gets extra money from criminal defendants and that they give the judge campaign donations and also a campaign loan in exchange for that quid pro quo.
But you have, I don't know. Having been a public official, this is always a slippery slope. But, you know, when you look at what the intent is, I mean, y'all cite 23 cases. I got to imagine this court is handling hundreds, if not thousands, of cases.
It's a minimum of 23 cases.
Well, let's say the minimum. Did we prove that in these 23 cases that public safety was not a criteria utilized for the utilization of the ankle monitoring?
So we don't know what is in the judge's head when the judge requires ankle monitoring and then says that someone has to go to the specific company that the judge is receiving campaign donations from.
So there's only two companies.
There's three.
There's including Gretna.
Right.
So that's a public entity.
That's right.
And they're limited in the number of cases that they do in Orleans, from what I understand. So really there are two companies.
So in an interview with them, they did not say that they were limited.
So there are two companies that they have a private-public collaborative with that they publicly bid?
No, there's no bidding process.
So how did they come to get these two companies?
So these were just companies that advertised as ankle monitoring companies, and one of them gave campaign donations, Newell, to judges, and then the other one did not. And what we found was that we
did. So who picked the two companies?
So it's up to the judge. Well, specifically, it's got to be up to the criminal defendant to determine which company they should use. Another alternative might be that.
No, but the point I'm trying to get to is not to belabor this, but who put together the RFQ or RFP?
There is no RFP.
So there's no minimum requirements. There's no bonding that you have to be able. There's no evidence that you bring to the court to prove that you're able and capable of doing the job?
No, sir.
So they just magically appeared. There's two companies doing electronic monitoring.
Three.
And no evidence, no file, no anything about their ability to do it, quality of their equipment, the amount of personnel that they have in order to provide this service, none of that?
That's right. And every other judge that we assess their case files, we assess their transcripts for, did not put a preference as to which company they actually went with, except for Judge Bonin. And Judge Bonin had the most ankle monitoring cases that we found. You know, we know from our other investigations that we only find the minimum number of cases, but Judge Bonin certainly had the most ankle monitoring cases in front of him out of all the other judges in criminal district court and magistrate court.
Some judges philosophically believe in electronic monitoring. I believed in it.
Certainly, we don't have an issue with that.
I thought it was a good practice, and others don't.
But going back to the public safety aspect, because you referred to it before, we found at a minimum that in 35% of these cases in front of Judge Bonin, the prosecutor objected to the ankle monitor instead of incarceration.
Of course.
And so that's the reason why we go back to
But the move of the city administration has been to reduce bail, reduce bond, and do alternatives to incarceration as it relates through the bail process. So that's not running violative of what most of the city leaders have been proposing and advocating for a period of time. I have more of a problem with a third-party vendor not having to meet minimum requirements as established by the court in the development of this relationship as opposed to anything else that has been said here, because I think that is what runs violative of good business practices to make sure that you're dealing with companies that are well-financed, that are trained, that know what they're doing, maintain their equipment, and are able to deliver a quality service if you're going to compel a defendant to pay the fee for the service as an alternative to going to jail.
And Noel, I just want to add that we couldn't agree with you more on that point. When we first started our research, we sent public records requests to these ankle monitoring companies directly to ask for their public contract, their RFP, their minimum requirements, and we received no response.
Right. Well, that's what I see as dangerous. That when you get crickets, that's a problem.
Or we received one response, and
the response was that they would not respond to us because
yes.
they had no public contract.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you're doing business with the court, and the court, in my view, is telling folks, and it may be that one company does the service better than others. I don't know. Obviously, no one's evaluated it because there's no criteria by which, you know, a matrix set up by which to judge the quality of the work that they do, which is a failure as well, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. That one kind of surprises me in that respect. All right, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and we're joined by Simone Levine, Executive Director, CourtWatch NOLA, and Veronica Bard, Project Manager with CourtWatch NOLA. They've just released their annual report, and we're talking about some of the observations that they made, and we've just been talking about the utilization of electronic monitoring, and I guess the failure of the court to really set up procurement guidelines for those services and leaves many questions that I think that need to be answered. So let's move on to the next issue that y'all think in a priority perspective that's important here.
So the second issue that we examined was drug testing that happens on site in criminal district court on the first floor. We saw at least 77 defendants who were held in contempt of court by criminal district court in 2018 for positive drug test results. However, we did end up learning that the criminal district court lab has the technology requisite for the first step in drug testing, which would be a screen. That essentially gives you a presumptive positive for drug screens. However, those results are not actually confirmed with the technology that should be available, which is a definitive confirmation test. The technology there is called gas or liquid chromatography combined with mass spectrometry. So in layman's terms, essentially, if you go to your doctor and you get a breast cancer screen, you get a positive screen for that, your doctor is not going to immediately tell you you have breast cancer. Your doctor will actually tell you, okay, now I'm going to run additional tests to see whether you actually have breast cancer and to confirm that. What's missing in the drug testing lab is the technology that's capable of confirming those drug test results. And so we find that 5 of the 12 criminal district courts incarcerated defendants for positive drug screens. That incarceration could be an average of 18 days. The one defendant was jailed up to 152 days. One defendant tested positive for marijuana alone and was incarcerated for 34 days. And then other judges tend to use all different types of sanctions for fines up to $500, 50 hours of community service. Now, what CourtWatch NOLA is not saying here is that drug testing should not occur.
Right.
We believe that there are therapeutic reasons and helpful reasons for drug testing criminal defendants if it's done correctly. However, we don't believe that at its current state that the drug testing lab is using sound scientific procedure, and therefore that has ramifications on each case where defendants are going Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of each week to be drug tested. They're paying $10 per drug test to do this, and they're being punished for it.
Well, I think most drug testing programs in the country utilizes presumptive tests. The false positive rate is relatively low, and they rely on that. I think more importantly, though, is that a lot of cases when the defendant is confronted with a positive test, they make an admission. So it's the combination of the admission and the presumptive positive on the test that leads to the ultimate, what we call shock incarceration, or some other punitive measure. But, you know, I would be interested to see what the percentage of defendants that once confronted with the positive, where they actually admitted to violating. Because
my experience
is it's a relatively high number. They know they're caught. And they know they don't want to BS the judge, because they know if they BS the judge is going to get even angrier. And they don't want to go through the secondary test, because then they know that that test can ultimately be used against them, where the presumptive one can, for purposes of violation of the probation or whatever, the court order. But once they go through the secondary one, there's another possible violation that are there more tools that the judge has available to him to sanction that individual. So a lot of the defendants are smart enough to know that they don't want to get to that secondary level, and they're willing to make the admission on the front end, just say mea culpa, take my medicine, and move on.
So the 77 defendants that we examined, we actually excluded any case file that said that the defendant had admitted to using a substance. The other thing that I wanted to push back on.
But did y'all look at previous tests to see whether or not they made those admissions in previous tests that they? Because you see, the part of the problem for the court is that if he failed three previous tests and he made the admissions, and the sanction is going up and up and up, it may be, you know, that they're seeing a pattern here, and you know,
right.
And we are
certainly aware of.
Right. So let us stop there, and we'll pick up right there when we come back. We got to get to a break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and we're talking to Court Watch NOLA, Simone Levine, Executive Director, and Veronica Bard, Project Manager for Court Watch NOLA. They just released their annual report. We were talking about drug test fees and drug testing. Part of the problem with that second panel, I don't disagree with you. You know, I'd rather be safe than sorry. The cost is probably something that's fairly prohibitive to get to that second level, because then you have to start a process where you're going to have licensed analysts to do the second tier, you know, because the presumptive test can be taken by anybody for the most part, as long as you adhere to evidentiary handling protocols. But it doesn't require a chemist or somebody that's licensed in that field to do those particular tests, not to mention the machinery on top of it as well. And that's probably some of the reluctance, because the court doesn't have the money for it, and the defendant you don't want to have to pass those fees on to the defendant, because it could be very much cost prohibitive. And we're already thinking about the courts being a pauper court anyway, where, you know, we're replete with the user fees as we go through there. So it is an alternative to being in jail. So you'd always have that question of who's going to finance this alternative.
And that's a great point to make, Newell, and that's also a point that we bring up in the report. So we found that in 2018, the criminal defendants had, so those are people who are pending trial, innocent before proven guilty, pay $74,233 just for drug tests alone. However, what we found was that the drug testing facility itself cost $350,126, so over $350,000. And then the collections department, those are the folks that collect the money from people that are paying for the drug tests, that cost over $130,000 in 2018. And so what happens when criminal defendants, 85%, who are poor, if they can't actually pay that price, well, then city council pays the price, and that we as citizens pay the price. And so I think where we would push back, we agree with everything that you said, Newell, where we'd push back is, we don't want people incarcerated for tests which we are not 100% sure are positive tests. If you go in and get your test screen for breast cancer, I want to know for sure I have breast cancer. I don't want somebody's halfway, half side opinion on it. I want to know for sure. And it should be the same for people that are actually incarcerated. So if we can't actually pay for the system, why are we requiring it in so often, so many cases? So that's
really
the question.
Well, because the alternative is to do away with it. I mean, when you look at the cost that they're putting up, the system is already subsidizing this benefit. So how about we reverse it and we say, well, what about all of the false negatives or the potential of the false negatives? Those are folks, I'm sure, that far outweigh the impact of the false positives that, you know, that are being, that show clean drug screens.
Without the science, we don't know. That's the problem.
I understand, but it cuts both ways. We have a lot of people that are benefiting by this system as well. As many, if not more, because I'm sure that the negative number is far greater than the positives.
But we don't know. That's the point.
On the drug testing.
If you go
in. Well, if you look at any study across the country, the positives are typically less than the negatives because people are trying to be compliant. They want to stay out of jail,
right.
So they're trying to stay clean.
Each machine actually has different specifications. And when we asked this drug testing lab specifically, what is your false positive rate? They don't track it. They don't track a false negative rate either.
They can't track it unless they do the secondary test.
Right. So
okay.
There's
which
a lot of
doing.
Unknowns here.
Right.
But what they do is the machine itself, and if you are handling everything positive in the appropriate fashion, has an average false positive rate. It's the same with a field test. When we did field tests out on the field and we tested for cocaine or we tested for methamphetamine or whatever it may be, we know that there's a certain percentage of false positives.
That's right. And that's the reason why you have the lab test that comes back as a result to confirm it.
That are going to be out there.
Right.
But it's used as a tool. And one of the tools is, you know, in the case of the court, as I said before, you confront the defendant and the defendant either makes an admission or doesn't make an admission. And in a lot of cases, they know they're caught. I'm dirty. I did the dirty. I'll take the medicine. And, you know, so.
But with the field test out in the field, you always have the lab result that comes back to confirm it. And that's exactly what we're talking about.
Right. But it gives you the necessary probable cause to make the arrest.
Initially. Right.
You know, initially,
but that somebody can't be incarcerated without that
confirmation. So the next situation y'all wanted to talk about was?
So one of the issues that the report is just so many different issues we had seen in 2018. One of the issues that we wanted to talk about was how we had found victims that were unable to get the accommodation of testifying with closed circuit TVs. Specifically, what we are recommending in the report is we're pushing the legislature to make a change in this area. There's four states that we found that allow victims and witnesses that are so traumatized by their crime to testify by closed circuit TV. And I think Governor Chris Christie passed a law last year relating to this issue. We found in court that even where victims and witnesses are 100% allowed to testify via closed circuit TV, that it still wasn't happening. So just imagine how terrified you are as a crime victim that to see the rapist in court in front of you, or to see your spouse that had just beaten the heck out of you before in front of you and threatening to do it again, and then to be forced to testify in front of them. What we are allowed in Louisiana, there's no law that prohibits it, is if an expert says that I, as a crime victim, am so traumatized by this aggressor in front of me that I'm able to testify via closed circuit TV. So we're asking the legislature to make this change like they did in New Jersey, in New York, in Illinois. New York actually did it through the courts.
Yeah. And the legislative process is the way to go, obviously, because of the balance of interests under the Sixth Amendment for the right of the defendant to confront his accuser.
That's right.
And, you know, it becomes very much a slippery slope, and you have to set up the objective criteria by which to judge that by so that you can make that accommodation, because very few defendants are going to waive that right to confront their accuser. And that's, you know,
but we've talked to DAs across the state of Louisiana, and in some circumstances, they are.
I'm not speaking against it. I mean, you just got to dot the I's, and I think y'all's approach is the right one. Going to the legislature, dot the I's, cross the T's, let them set that up under the law, allow it, and so it can move forward.
Right.
Yeah. We've got to get to another break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're with Court Watch NOLA talking about their annual report. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and we're talking to Simone Levine and Veronica Bard of Court Watch NOLA, and we were just talking about a number of different things as it relates to the video teleconferencing of witnesses and so forth that reach a threshold of being traumatized by this whole process, and asking for a legislative remedy to this, as has been done in, I think you mentioned, four other states. What other observations in the report are you guys making?
So much. You know, we really would encourage people to look into the report. One of the issues that we also flagged was inefficiency in criminal court. And typically, judges are blamed for this inefficiency. And our report really gets to the drivers of inefficiency in the court, and we find that it, in fact, isn't the judges, although they've been blamed for it, you know, for so long now. It's not to say that they don't have some improvement, but really what we had found, and we looked at the 98 oldest cases in criminal district court. The oldest we found was over 13 years old. And in those oldest cases, the 98 oldest cases, we found that 34% of the continuances occurred because the defendant was not brought to court. Incarcerated defendant was not brought to court when scheduled. We then dissected that 34%, and we found that in 57% of the continuances where an incarcerated defendant was not produced, that it's the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office that was responsible for bringing the defendant to court and did not do so. And so what we also looked at in the report when it related to inefficiency is that it's really up to the sheriff's office to tell the prosecution or tell the court where the incarcerated defendant is housed. And in many circumstances, that also didn't happen. So the court can't get the defendant from an incarcerated facility if they actually don't know where they are located. So we would love your input on this.
I just for the benefit of the listening audience, we're also talking about cases where inmates have already been shipped into the state system on
another charge. That's right.
So they would have to be brought in from DOC, and we have no adult DOC facilities in the metropolitan area. So they come from relatively far away, so that it requires, as you pointed out, planning to make sure that they're on the docket and everyone knows that they need to be produced in court on a date certain in order to go to trial.
And what we found was in the second oldest case, we found that the Department of Corrections did not produce that specific defendant 43 different times. Didn't produce them in court.
Of those 98 cases, of the oldest 98.
It's the second oldest case that we're referring to. And in the oldest case, we found that Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office did not produce the defendant 16 different times. And so it's very important to highlight these inefficiencies and the drivers of these inefficiencies, because these cases are really the oldest in the court.
Yeah. You know, when you go through the process, there's more than one player. There's a clerk of court's office that the DA notifies the clerk notifies the jail, that goes through that process. I'm not saying it's an excuse, but it's a shared responsibility, and it's fairly low-hanging fruit at the end of the day, one in which ought to be resolved for sure,
right.
Because these are things that really don't cost money to resolve, right?
Right. And then, you know, finally, we looked to victims who were that showed up to bail hearings. We specifically found that although the district attorney is not required to do so, that the that the district attorney should be showing up to these bail hearings. And the number one reason we cited was because victims have no one, crime victims who show up to these bail hearings have no one to transmit that information to. There's been a whole lot of conversation about bail reform and what bail reform really is about. We strongly believe that crime victims have some of the most pivotal information about whether a defendant is a public safety problem, whether they're going to be rearrested, whether they're going to return to court. If no one's talking to them in magistrate court at these bail hearings, that information is information the judge is not receiving.
We got to get to another break, and we'll pick that conversation up when we return. This is Newell and Court Watch NOLA. Stay with us. We're back, and we're talking to Court Watch NOLA, Simone Levine, Executive Director, and Veronica Bard, Project Manager. And I just want to publicly thank you y'all again for sending me a copy of the report. I read through it. I think it's very well done. It's footnoted appropriately where there are observations that are made that you make it clear, you know, whether it's objective, subjective, what's it based on, statute or otherwise. So I don't get, and I want folks, when I make observations, it's not that I believe that you guys are sucker punching anybody, because I don't believe that at all. In fact, I think a lot of the if not all of it, is presented in a fashion that's appropriate, and it's one that should be considered. I wish you didn't have to work as hard to get the information, because it would seem to me that when you're running a business, if you run something like a business, a lot of this would be something that they would keep in the normal course of business.
That's right.
You know, and it would be something that folks should be concerned about. So I wanted to talk about the bail thing. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about the bail situation in the DA's office.
Can I just interrupt one second?
Yeah, go ahead.
And just say, Newell, that we always appreciate you speaking to us about our report. You're one of the few that reads through the whole entire report. You have a background in understanding the report. And we always appreciate your observations.
Well, thank you. And I know you and I talk offline, you know,
sure
about different issues all the time, and kind of get my perspective based on my experience. And I view it as a great working relationship and looking at these contemporary issues and trying to improve. It doesn't mean I know it all. I don't.
Most of the times, we agree with your observations.
You know, I have observations, some are easy to do, some not so easy to do. I think for the most part, most of the judges over there are trying to do the right thing. They do come from different philosophical bents, and it's, you know, and sometimes that creates a little bit of a conflict, and I get it. It is what it is.
This year we actually gave a commendation to Judge Kiva Landrup Johnson as well.
So I'm going to have to get you guys to come back, because I want to finish this report, because now we've run out of time, and I got to get to the cash contest. So thank you all very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Ready to win some money? Now's your chance to win $1,000 in our $12,000 day giveaway. The code word this.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.